I am really glad to be able to be back here today, as last week you did not want me here. Trust me on that. I am very thankful for Mike, who filled in for me and went through my sermon. However, I do have to bring something up. You know, I've told a lot of jokes up here. I mean, a lot of jokes up here. And I often get feedback from somebody in the peanut gallery, and I'm listening to this sermon that he gave last week. Kathy and I listened to it at home on the internet, and he told a joke that I'm kind of thinking was about the same speed as most of my jokes, as in pretty darn corny. And you all laughed at him really loud. I've never gotten that kind of laughter like you guys got. It came through the microphone. I'm thinking, do I need to sing my punchlines? Is that the cue? Is that what? I don't know. I was like, wow, they're like totally busting up at that. And I thought, I don't know. Maybe we just have different senses of humor. Or maybe I'm just not funny. Let me ask you a question. This is another interactive. This is something that you can just shout out an answer to. What is your favorite kind of restaurant? Clean. Okay, yeah, well. Shout it out loud enough I can make you out. Seafood. Texas Roadhouse, steak place. Okay, Italian. All right. My absolute favorite kind of restaurant. Now, don't get me wrong. This isn't a restaurant I want to eat at every single time. But my favorite kind of restaurant is a small town like Main Street diner. You know what I'm talking about? Greasy spoon type of place, although I don't want the spoons to be greasy. I like clean, like you said. I like the little cafes that open at 5 o'clock in the morning and close at about 2 p.m. You know what I'm talking about? You can go in there and it's guaranteed that you can get yourself a wonderful breakfast that's going to be, whatever it is, it's going to have eggs and biscuits and gravy along with it probably, at least if I'm eating there. This is my favorite kind of restaurant. And one of the things that you can obtain at a small town like Main Street diner type of place, you can't usually get. I mean, maybe you'll find it in other places, but I guarantee you, if you're at one of these diners, you can get this. And it is something available there that is more precious than gold. And what you will find there is the answers to life, the universe, and everything. You will get all of the solutions to all of the world's problems. Because undoubtedly, at every single one of these places, there will be a table of sages sitting there with their senior coffee, usually at a back booth or a back table, and they are going over every problem that the world faces today and how to fix it. If only the UN and Washington would spend more time in downtown diners, they would figure out how it is to fix the whole world. And then these sages go and get a haircut and walk their dog. It's a good thing that we have these people who can solve all the world's problems. Because the world is a pretty awful place. There is so much suffering going on in the world right now. The only way to look at it, the only good way to look at it, is that for the overwhelming majority of the history of mankind, it's been way worse. When you look at the world's a terrible place. The world's a dangerous place. There are awful, awful things going on. But the simple fact of it is, up until about 75 years ago, the amount of suffering in the world made what's going on now look good by comparison. Think about this. For the overwhelming majority of the time that humans have ever been here, for most people, most of the time was a struggle just to have food to put in their mouths. And for a lot of the world, it still is that way. However, things are improving. Things are better than they used to be. It's actually pretty remarkable how much of the world's suffering has ceased, not only just within my lifetime, but within the lifetime of my youngest daughter. I don't know if you know this, but between 2000 and 2012, the amount of people who were in absolute poverty, and I'm not talking about percentages, I'm talking about actual numbers of people. While the population has gone up, the number of people who live in absolute poverty was halved during that time frame. Cut in half. In fact, in 2000, there was 1.9 billion people who were in absolute abject poverty. Today, that number is down to 650 million. But it is still 650 million people who live in abject poverty. That is the single best rate of improvement in the history of mankind by a huge margin. And it was 3 years faster than even the most optimistic predictions ever guessed at. There is a downside to that great statistic, however. While it has gone down and continues to do so, there are still a lot of people in absolute poverty. It's been a great improvement, but it's not quite enough. The world is not fixed. The other thing to keep in mind is that what is considered absolute poverty is the people who are living on $2, about $2 a day or less. Yes, we've brought that number hugely down, but let me tell you something. Almost 60% of the planet, almost 60% of the planet lives on $10 or less a day. And the world is still a pretty terrible place. Even when even by just that measure. But the world is a terrible place, even for those of us who are in the top 38 or 40% that aren't exceedingly poor. Three of the books that I'm reading right now are all somewhat addressing this issue. One is called Life at the Bottom by Theodore Dalrymple. Yes, same spelling. Another one is 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos by Dr. Jordan Peterson. And the third one is called Blood and Earth, Modern Slavery, Ecocide, and the Secret to Saving the World by Kevin Bales. They're all written by people who see that there are terrible things going on in the world. And they're all offering some sort of solution to try to fix the world. All of the solutions they offer, however, are doomed to fail to some degree or another. Probably, well, maybe, possibly, with one exception. But I'm not certain on that. This is not to say that they don't all have some really great ideas, and that they have some things to offer that will, in fact, make improvements in the lives of those who practice them and the people around them. But I'm pretty sure that they won't succeed because they don't offer the solution to fixing the world. The solution. The way to fix the world was something uttered by Jesus, which was so basic and so simple that we hardly take much time to reflect upon it now. But when he said it, no one had ever said it before. They had come close. They'd come this close to what he was saying, but they failed to grasp. Did I just see all the lights go dim? Ooh. They had failed to grasp the simple perfection of it. Perfection which is so difficult that perhaps no one dared to think about it before. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 7, verses 12 through 14, if you would. Matthew 7, 12 through 14 says, "So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few." The first verse of this we call the Golden Rule. It's something we teach to children before they go to preschool. Well, some of us do. I'm pretty sure Stephen Delgard's mother didn't teach it to him before he came to kindergarten with me. But I digress. We say to our children, "Do unto others as you would have them do to you." And then, very often, we completely get it wrong when we explain it to them. We say, "So, little Johnny, when you're at school, don't be mean to little Susie because you wouldn't want her to be mean to you." No! Wrong! Absolutely wrong! Completely backwards! This is a good thing to teach people. And all of Western society, in fact, all of civilized society rests upon that concept. But it is not what Jesus taught. At least not what he here said was the summation of all the scriptures that God had given them. Hillel, the great Jewish rabbi, Socrates, the Greek philosopher, Confucius, the Chinese father of thought, they all taught, "Little Johnny, don't be mean to little Susie." But it is nowhere near what Jesus said. All great thinkers have come up with the concept that we should avoid doing evil to others because we wouldn't want them to do evil to us. But Jesus turned this on its head. And he put a standard down for his followers, which is 100 times more difficult. Not doing evil is easy. It doesn't require any effort whatsoever. In fact, not doing evil to other people doesn't require you to get out of bed in the morning. You can not do evil to other people and not get up. Just stay in bed. Then you've not done evil to anybody. Is it a good thing not to do evil to other people? Yes, it is. But it's also really, really easy. In fact, if you have a big problem with not doing evil to the other people in your life, the people that you run across, if you find it really tough to not be mean to people, chances are you might be a psychopath. Because not doing mean to other people, not doing evil to them, for no reason whatsoever, isn't hard. All you have to do is mind your own business. It's just refraining from action. Refraining from doing evil is the mere basic requirement of having a society. Do you think that society is crazy now? When like 1 in 1,000,000 people decide to go on a killing spree? Imagine If you had plausible reason to think that every person you meet on the street might try to beat you and rob you, or that someone might kill you for no other reason than watching you die. We don't live our lives this way. We couldn't. It wouldn't be possible to go to the store if you thought everybody was going to try to do you harm. Even those of us who know just how terrible a tiny few can be and keep vigilant against that lest we run into one, we don't operate on the premise that everyone is going to be this way by default. We operate each and every day on the basic concept that 99.95% of everybody you run into is not going to harm you for no reason whatsoever. Jesus did not call his followers to live the way that nearly every single human being in civilization already does. He called us to something far, far more. Verse 12. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. Jesus is here capping off the Sermon on the Mount. He's been preaching for 3 chapters how people who wish to follow God should behave and live out their lives. And this is where he reaches the peak of that teaching, the golden rule. The rest of the chapter is just a warning about those who don't. This passage is so difficult compared with the inverse phrasing because it requires you as a Christian not just to not do evil to others, but to actively do good for them. Literally, any time you see someone in a situation in which you would want help, if you were in their place, Jesus is saying we need to help. That is the whole meaning of the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan didn't just refrain from beating and robbing the guy on the road. The priest and the Levite did that. They followed that. The priest and the Levite probably walked away thinking of themselves as righteous. I didn't rob him. I didn't go over and see if there was anything else I could get. I didn't beat the guy up. I did no evil to that man. Jesus is saying that's not good enough. Jesus is saying you have to be like the Good Samaritan who goes out of his way to help the person because the person needs help. The Good Samaritan, he stops the business that he is doing. I'm sure he had some place to go. The Good Samaritan, he takes on cost. He goes to great effort. He even puts himself in danger to be willing to help the man. Jesus said that we have to be people who are looking around, actively looking at the world and constantly having in our minds, how can I make things better? This is how we are supposed to be thinking, which is to say, we are not required to be thinking, how can I give those other people every single thing that they want? That's not what Jesus is saying. Do you know why? Because if we gave people everything they wanted, it wouldn't be good for them. I know this for a fact, not just because of my dealings with other people, but because I know myself. I know it would not be good if I was given everything that I ever wanted. Trust me on this. It's very plain. Talked about his grandson being named practically Luke Skywalker. It's Luke Skyler. There is a 100% chance that if I had Jedi powers, I would abuse them. Absolutely. Washington would be a totally different place than it is. I'd be thinking, yeah, this is okay for me to do. I would not be good. I would abuse those powers. If I was given all the money in the world, trust me, it wouldn't be good for me. Because there's so many things that I'd be tempted with. There are people that I know, personally, who the safest and the best for them is when they are dead, broke, and incarcerated. Because any time that they have money and the freedom to do with it as they please, they do harm to themselves and to those around them. Merely giving someone what they want is not what Jesus is saying here. He is saying, what can I do to make things better? Of the three books that I mentioned earlier, they're not going to fix the world. 12 Rules for Life may make some people be better, but I don't think it will fix the world. Because almost all of what Dr. Peterson teaches people is to how to improve themselves, and almost all of them fall into the category of don't do evil things to others. A category, well, some of it falls into do good for yourself, as in not being self-destructive. Those are good things, but they won't fix the world. They will at best make the world less miserable. Life at the Bottom, its proposition is that the government needs to stop rewarding bad behavior with social welfare benefits. He makes a good case for how this will actually improve the lives of those currently dependent upon them and living self-destructive lives. But again, this falls into the category of don't do harm to others. Blood and Earth, which is written by a left-wing climate activist, it may have accidentally stumbled into the realm of how to fix the world, because his solution to the world's problems is about getting people out of real, actual slavery and slavery-like conditions, which will have a beneficial effect to everyone on Earth. This, depending on the specifics, I haven't finished the book yet, so it might fall into the category of actively doing good for other people. But I suspect from what I've read that his answer is going to be tax the rich people and give it to the poor. But I'm holding out hope. The only real proposal ever in the history of the world which can actually fix the world is for people to follow what Jesus teaches and go out of our way to do unto others what we would want them to do to us. Quite frankly, if everyone merely did this simple but terribly hard, it's simple, but it is terribly hard. If we just did this most of the time, nearly every problem we ever see in the news would go away, with the exception of maybe natural disasters. But people won't. How do I know that most people won't? Because of the next words that come out of Jesus' mouth. In verses 13 and 14, he says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those that enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few." Jesus knew, and so do we really, that the overwhelming number of people are not going to follow this or many other of his teachings. Why? Because they're difficult and they require self-sacrifice. In fact, it becomes clear that many who claim to be his followers won't be willing to do many of the things that he teaches in the Sermon on the Mount. But that's next week's sermon. So if most people are not going to follow the simple yet difficult solution for fixing the world, what hope is there? Is the world simply doomed to be an awful place forever? Well, yes and no. Yes, large portions of many people's lives on earth will continue to be miserable so long as selfish people take advantage of them and continue to not only not do good for people, but actually do evil for them. There are a lot of people out there who actually do evil on people because it will make them more pleasant in the short term. But no, it does not mean the world is doomed forever. In the fact that at least one point, at one point in time, every knee will bow before Christ and he will bring an end to this kind of suffering. But also no, because every single time that someone who follows Christ chooses to actively do good in the lives of those who are around them, then that particular person ceases to live in that particular misery. Can I fix the world by my willingness to do good to just that one person who is before me? No. But as the cliche and the bumper sticker says, very rightly, I can fix the world for that one person. But this requires a few things of us. Not only does it require us to be willing to do good to someone when we have the opportunity, but equally as important, we have to be willing to see that opportunity. I hope you understood what I just said. Be actively putting your mind to seeing the good that you can do. The same Jesus who told the story of the Good Samaritan, who does all of this huge stuff. I mean, you think about what the Good Samaritan did. It is huge. He could have gotten himself killed by the same robbers who just beat up this guy. What Jesus puts out in the parable of the Good Samaritan, that's no small thing. How many people do you think would put their own life at risk, put whatever it was they were doing on hold, take all of their efforts and their money to take care of somebody? That's huge. But the same Jesus who taught that huge thing of being good to others also said in Matthew 10, verse 42, "And whoever gives one of these little ones even a cold cup of water because he is a disciple, truly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward." There is a world of a difference between the person who just offers someone in need a drink of water and the Good Samaritan. There's a world of difference. And there's a world of opportunities in between. And we need to be willing to open our eyes and see the opportunities that lie before us. Because when you do good to somebody, you know what? They're usually going to be flabbergasted. When you do something that has no way of doing anything good for you, it's not a selfish thing you're doing, it's completely just to help them, most of the time they're going to look at you weird. Because most of the world doesn't do that. Most of the world is not willing to do that. Most of the world says, I don't hurt other people, so I'm a good person. Well, it's a great thing that you don't hurt other people. But Jesus says it requires just a little bit more than that. He says we need to go and do good to other people. From a glass of water to the Good Samaritan and everything in between. And when we do, every time you do that, the world gets fixed a little teeny bit at a time because Jesus is right there working through us to fix the world. This is what he said we're to do. But in the end, the world gets fixed one way. The world gets fixed by accepting Jesus Christ and what he did for the world on the cross. We're studying Ephesians on Wednesday nights, and we're talking about different things. And there's some things in Ephesians that sound like Calvinistic predestination. But we did point out that in 1 Timothy chapter 2, I think it was, the first few verses there, it says that God wants all people to come to a saving knowledge of His grace. The only way to be saved in the long run for eternity is through what Jesus Christ did for us. In the meantime, and from the time we accept Christ onward, we should be doing good for other people, both to alleviate their suffering and to lead them to make that decision as well. If that's not a decision that you have personally made, I would invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.